Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome and thank you for listening in. My name is Linda Mooney, and this is Other Worlds of Romance on Blog Talk Radio. And I'm very excited tonight. My favorite genre has popped up again, and I've got Joe Reyes as my guest author. Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. How's the weather up there in New Jersey?
Oh, it's actually really warm out here today. It's kind of dry, too. So.
Yeah. I can tell. I mean, and we're starting to get into we're in that really hot part of August, too. So Joe has written a YA post-apocalyptic novel called Aftermath. And this thing is very different. It's very unique. And like I said, post-apocalyptic, those of you who know me know that I love post-apocalyptic movies and novels and things like that. And after Joe's going to be, has a reader, in fact, he's got his girlfriend there, Alyssa. She's going to be reading an excerpt from the book. And if you'd like to talk to Joe and Alyssa, you're more than welcome to. The call-in number is 646-727-2932. Or if you want, I have the chat room open and you can ask a question there and I will pass it along. Or if I know you're listening there on Facebook and all, you're more than welcome to email me your question, linda@lindamooney.com, and I'll pass it along for them to answer. Now, Joe, we were talking earlier about the fact that the big popular thing right now is the post-apocalyptic YA and dystopian, as they're calling it now, dystopian novels. But yours is a little bit different from that. How is it different?
Well, it actually reads like a TV show. That's the biggest thing, because the chapters are a little bit shorter, and there's about 7 different characters, so it just keeps cycling throughout, you know, each one of their little storylines. So it kind of feels like a TV show, with, you know, the camera cuts, different parts of the United States, so. And it's, like I said, chapters are really short and quick, too. So it's a really fast read, even though it is, you know, over 80,000 words. So it does take a little bit getting used to. I've had, like, a few friends that are really big readers. So when they start reading it, they're a little bit confused by it because they never actually read something like that before. So hopefully I might be creating some kind of a new writing style my own way.
Ooh. And all. Have you thought about maybe turning it into a screenplay?
Oh, that's the absolute goal, is a... You know, an HBO TV show. That's the ultimate thing I want to have out of this.
Now, have you thought about maybe putting it out in audiobook format?
I'm actually in the process of looking through that now, but the problem is it does take about, you know, 2-3 months for the guys doing the audiobook to get it completely done. So we'll be a little bit in the future, but it's something I'm definitely looking to this week. And a few other... You know, authors I talked to on Twitter that had their works done, audiobooks too, and it's worked out really well for themselves. I think it's just another avenue I'm going to take a shot at.
Yeah, well, because you've got the book out right now is in ebook format, and you have it out in paperback, which is really neat. But with something like this, this book just screams having an audiobook format of it because of the way that it reads and all. Well, Joe, I'm going to let you introduce Alyssa, and basically I'm turning the floor over to you so that you can take it from there and give us the blurb, and then she can continue on with the excerpt. So take it away.
Let me introduce my girlfriend, Alyssa Adamson, and she's going to read the back cover of the book, and then she's going to start reading the character, one of my favorite characters, definitely her favorite character, Sarah. So I'll give it to Alyssa now.
Okay. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi.
Hi, good to meet you.
Good to meet you, too.
And he roped you into doing this.
Yep. I'm the one with the public speaking know-how, so I guess.
Okay. Well, tell him he owes you a steak dinner afterwards.
Oh, I'll definitely let him know.
So let us have the blurb on this thing.
All right. The back of the book reads, Aftermath, a post-apocalyptic novel. Aftermath is a growing series about war, love, brutality, and most of all, survival. What was once the United States has become a savage, post-apocalyptic environment where the worst of the worst prosper and the remaining good hide. The series features a brutal setting where seven characters in different parts of the United States must adapt to this new environment. The fight-or-flight mentality plays into the story as the nation is divided into factions fighting for control of the country. The government is outnumbered, outgunned, and forced into hiding as well to recoup their forces. The novel follows a fast-paced momentum from the first page to the last word. The plot pits these characters against the elements and each other, with plot lines intertwining on opposite sides of the war effort. And one character's quest for revenge can jeopardize not only the war outcome, but the reshaping of the entire nation. With an ever-changing storyline and evolving characters, the Aftermath series gets more intense with every chapter. But what these characters don't realize is the terrifying evil making its way across the ocean.
Mm.
And I'm going to be reading chapter 3.
Okay, and what's kind of led up to chapter 3?
Each chapter is told from a different person's perspective. This is the first chapter of this particular character, Sarah, who is a sex slave for a group of cannibals.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Definitely up the drama. We have chapter 3, Sarah. People in beans again, a raggedy-looking man says as Sarah passes him a plate. He glares down, disappointed at the meal of perfectly cut human flesh and a side dish of green beans. Sarah hands out more plates to the group of men huddled around a fire. When you guys kill something other than people, you'll get something else to eat, she says with a sarcastic smile, walking off. It's near insane to talk back to these guys. They are psychotic killers, but she is protected. Marcus, their leader, has taken a liking to her. So it's a choice of be killed, be raped and then killed, or be his willing sex slave. Sometimes she doesn't know if she made the right choice. Before going back to the kitchen, she stops by every group to see if they all have something to eat. Dozens of groups gather around, having their breakfast. The field is littered with dirty men and women, feasting on human remains. Probably over 100 in total, she guesses. The savages is what they're called. The group started after the bombs fell about 5 years ago. They were small at first, but they've since grown into a much larger army. This gives them better resources and a nice cut of whatever they take from towns. All they do is kill and raid villages. They swoop in, kill, take everything, and leave. They take in recruits sometimes, if they seem to fit the part. The survivors don't last long. They are usually killed and displayed as a message to discourage others. For years, they tried the whole nomad lifestyle, but when the army got bigger, they realized they had to settle down. It's a lot easier than constantly uprooting the whole camp. And they have no reason to leave. There are always animals in the forest. A river provides fresh water and fish. Armies are too afraid to attack them. They can't survive an all-out military assault, but the government has much more important enemies than them to worry about. They all wear custom-made armors consisting of materials they find on the road. Sports gear is a big part of it. Elbow pads, football pads, helmets, anything they can find. A lot of it is hand-sewn and made from animal skins. The farm would also pose a problem for moving. Horses are bred and domesticated as transportation. Without cars and without gasoline to run them, they are a necessary component of life here. Each savage has the brand of an S on the back of his or her shoulder, indicating initiation into the group. It is given after their first kill. After a big massacre and initiation, they will celebrate with a great feast, their victims. Sarah never likes thinking about how many people one dead body feeds. The thought makes her sick. The taste has always bothered her. She may force herself to eat flesh when she absolutely must, but she is and always has been a vegetarian. Even when they spruce it up with spices and other ingredients, it is still a person, and no amount of sauce can change that. Sarah's stomach starts to rumble. She hasn't eaten much in days. Usually, she's able to sneak extra beans and vegetables because the others love flesh, but the shortage of them is now beginning to hit her. Hopefully, Penny can get me something, she thinks, walking into the large kitchen tent. The sight doesn't help her appetite. Penny is in the middle of carving someone up. 3 years of culinary school, and I'm making foot fillet for 100 ingrates, Penny mocks as she hacks off a foot with a butcher's knife. Sarah feels sick again. She covers her mouth to hold the vomit back. The smell of blood is too much. Aw, sweetie, not feeling good? Penny says affectionately, walking up to her. She doesn't get it. Her shirt is covered in blood, and it's making Sarah sicker. But she needs a hug. New necklace? Sarah asks, seeing a piece of metal chain falling from Penny's shirt. One of Eric's men gave it to me. A gold snowflake hangs from the end, surrounded by pretty little stones. Which guy? Sarah asks. Penny's face betrays her disgust, the creepy-looking one with the cuts. The kitchen tent is filled with people preparing food for the group. There's a huge fire going, and the bodies are put on a metal gate over the fire to barbecue. The savages know that uncooked flesh can kill them. They are as smart as they are ruthless. That's why they've been around for all 5 years. You hungry? Penny asks. Sarah shakes her head. He'll probably make me eat with him later. Penny sighs but says nothing. They both know what Marcus is going to do to her. Sarah will have to eat flesh again, among other things. Penny doesn't like the idea of eating people either, but she is a chef and can trick herself into thinking she's eating something else. With all the spices she's schooled in, it's almost easy. Everyone who doesn't like it has ways of coping, but most of the savages love the taste and the trophy. Eating the very people they killed makes them feel tougher. Sarah would be the first to admit the taste of it isn't bad, but that freaks her out the worst. You smell nice today, she says from Penny's arms, covered by her blonde hair. I found some shampoo. I'll give you some later tonight, Penny says with a smile. Now come on, you have to bring the men food. The meeting's starting. Penny releases her, only to hand Sarah a tray of appetizing human parts and vegetables. How do I look? Sarah inquires. Penny adjusts a few out-of-place strands of hair on her head and smiles. You look great. She takes a deep breath before leaving the tent. Sarah is nervous when she walks up to Marcus's tent, as usual. The smell of meat immediately finds her nose, but she gulps and tries to put it out of her mind. His tent is huge, so big that the material had to be sewn together from different canvases. A few children run by her. Sarah quickly moves out of the way, keeping a firm grip on the tray. She slips slightly, but manages to keep her balance. That could have ended badly. A pair of guards stands outside, holding large spears. One pulls the tent door open so she can enter. The tent is already illuminated with candles, allowing her to see Marcus, a burly, bearded man, sitting at the head of the table. He is wearing a bear pelt over his patched-together leather armor. He killed the bear himself with only a knife. The armor and pelt are Marcus's most prized possessions, besides his son, Franklin. Franklin was born from Marcus's first wife and is being raised to be just like him, a bastard. With Marcus's wife dead, Marcus is looking for someone else to have his children, and he's always been attracted to the young and pretty Sarah since the first time they met. Sarah's brown hair is short, but the longer strands are braided together after a picture Penny saw in a magazine. It's the older, blonde woman who always cuts and styles her hair. Franklin is unruly during the meeting, but Marcus barely notices. The boy has a toy, made from a rabbit skull, and he uses it as a gavel against the tables. Marcus doesn't mind, but he's the only one. No one would dare say anything. Every morning, Marcus holds a meeting consisting of about half a dozen captains. How are we on supplies, he says as he grabs a cup of wine. Victor, a balding old man with glasses, looks over a piece of paper. Ammo is down. We can probably survive a few skirmishes at this rate. Nothing too serious. Before the bombs fell, Victor was an accountant. Numbers and problem-solving is what he did for a living. Now, if something ever happened to Marcus, he would be the next in line to rule. Victor isn't a killer, but he is the smartest bet to lead the group if the need arises. We did find a few boxes of earplugs, he adds, looking up from his paper. Thank God, the people are complaining. Marcus replies with a laugh. Sarah tries to slip in unnoticed. Her hope is to just lay the food down and leave without garnering any attention, but there is nowhere to put it, so she waits in silence for a space to open up on the table. We need to send out more scouting parties. Cortez wants us ready. Something's happening, Marcus continues. Soon. When did we start listening to what Cortez wants? One of the savages demands. Marcus slams his fist down onto the table with a roar that startles Sarah into nearly dropping the tray. We owe them. Don't forget that ever, he yells. Franklin returns to banging his toy on the table. Marcus puts an affectionate hand on his son's head, running his fingers through his hair. Cortez mentioned something about a bomb. He didn't give specifics. All he said was to stay away from the government bases. The chair creaks loudly as he stands and walks to a large map on the wall. We don't have enough guns or people to go west. The north past the border is too cold for scouting. This is the best place for us to wait. A few scouts spotted a town not far from here. Little resistance, they figured from the looks of it, Marcus says. Marcus looks over at Eric, a young man with dirty long hair. He wears a dusty leather overcoat and carries a black revolver with a cowboy hat to match. There and back here by tomorrow. It'll take a dozen of my men, Eric says confidently. Good. Bring back slaves. We lost a big chunk of them on the trip here, the leader smiles. Victor laughs down at his papers. What? Marcus asks. The slaves he brings back are barely alive. So they'll fit in with the slaves we have now, Eric jokes. Marcus rolls his eyes. Just get it done. Bring half of them to liberty. Liberty. Sarah is instantly filled with excitement. The paradise. She's only been there once, and it was long ago, over a year, but the vision is ingrained in her mind. They have running water, houses, and some even have electricity, a luxury they could never hope for here. She often wonders why they don't just live there with Cortez, but she knows better than to question Marcus. And bring the other half to Harkin, he instructs. There is a short silence in the room. Let me guess. He wants the kids, Eric finally says. Victor coughs. When did you become a moralist? What should I get in return? Marcus hands Eric the paper. Victor made a list. Just make sure he doesn't try to push any of the hillbilly heroin. God knows that's the last thing we need. The cowboy looks over the list with disappointment. That's a few days' ride. Victor hands over the map of the nearby town. So bring a book. From the looks of it, you can follow the river down to Liberty, Marcus says, standing. I'll send the second group down to Liberty with Jeff, Eric replies, picking at his fingernail. Marcus crosses the tent, gesturing to the larger map occupying his wall and the X in the center of it. The government is fighting back. It's strong, too. A few of our camps have already been decimated. Skinned corpses, Victor adds matter-of-factly, shifting through some papers. He barely seems to acknowledge the gruesomeness of what he has just seen. What? Another man at the table asks. Marcus gathers himself. One of our outposts was burned to the ground. Everyone inside was skinned. That stays in this room, Victor announces. Our people shouldn't be any more on edge than they need to be. We're losing this war, people, not because of skinned corpses. Sarah gags, and her hopes of remaining invisible go unheard when Marcus looks up. Put it here, he orders, returning to his seat. The chair creaks under his weight. Sarah places the tray before him and promptly makes a break for the door. More wine, he says, stopping her in her tracks. She grabs a bottle and fills his cup. Marcus sips at it, spilling the stale wine onto his beard. Others are unifying and winning. Eventually, we aren't going to know who the hell we're fighting anymore. Do you think it was those archers? One of the captains asks. Doubtful. No arrows were recovered, Victor says. Eric, they might have migrated north. Try to stay out of the thick woods until we've rearmed. Not a problem, Eric replies. Sarah stays put, unsure of the repercussions she would be enduring if she made a run for it. Marcus chomps on the human meat, savoring it loudly. She wonders for all of a second if he will offer the other men any, but it doesn't look like it. She tries to pick a spot on the wall, hoping to distance herself from the noise, but the sound of him tearing the flesh with his teeth holds every ounce of her attention. She closes her eyes and takes a few calming breaths. Just think of something happy. Penny. Think of Penny. So what are we thinking? Too messy to be government, Eric says. We'll hold some soldiers next time. See if they have any information they're willing to share, Marcus replies nonchalantly. Burn the town to the ground. Leave us. The group gets up and filters one by one out the door. Eric takes a carrot from the table and shoves it into his pocket, followed closely by Victor, who takes Franklin by the hand. Marcus waves a little at the boy. Eric looks over at Sarah on his way out and gives her a polite nod. She smiles politely back. He's way too nice to be with them, she thinks. Sarah turns and tries to walk out with the crowd, but Marcus stands, putting his food down. Stay. Damn. Tears surface in her eyes, waiting for the moment she has dreaded all day. She turns to him, already stripping off her shirt in the hopes of speeding up the process. Her master smiles, eyes roving hungrily over every inch of her exposed skin. Sarah fights a strong urge to cover herself back up. Do it, she whispers in defeat, knowing there will be no help for her and no way to fight. Now, that's not how we do this, Marcus says in as close to a tender voice as he can manage. She turns, and he presses himself up against her back. His beard tickles the back of her neck, and the smell of wine and smoked meat rape her nostrils, sending a shiver down her spine. She closes her eyes hard, anticipating a long day.
That's the Sarah.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. And Alyssa. Alyssa?
Oh, hold on.
Hi. Yay. You have the voice to do narration
you.
For audiobooks. You do.
I'll look
and
into
I mean, you've got the inflection, and I seriously consider you've got to look into that and offer. If you've got the ways of doing audiobook narration, you know, with the microphone and sound room and all, I'd look into that because you have the inflection. You kind of act it out, and that's exactly what authors look for in an audiobook narration, rather than just reading it. So you might want to look into it and all. And because remember, narration isn't so much reading the book; it's being an actor and acting it out and all.
Oh, thank
so
you.
And you've got that. So tell Joe you're not reading to your full potential yet. You need to.
No, I'll charge him next time.
Yes, definitely. There you go. And all. So, well, thank you very much for reading that.
Thanks for having me.
What?
And she has a marvelous voice. And I was telling her she has the voice for audiobook narration.
Yes, definitely does.
And it's excellently. And I've been looking at your website. By the way, readers, you need to check out. You can find Joe at joereyesauthor.com, joereyesauthor.com. You can also find him on Twitter at joereyesauthor. And he's on Facebook as Joe Reyes Author. And also,
I also have an Instagram with the same thing, Joe Reyes Author as well.
Oh. So you need to check those out. You need to go like his page and all and check him out. And we do have a question here from Sasha. She says, how long did it take you to write this?
It really didn't take me that long. I actually wrote this right around the time of Hurricane Sandy. So I had no power for days and days. So all I did was pretty much write stuff. Once I get a groove going, it takes me, like I said, about 4 months. So, I mean, the hardest part is actually just the in-depth planning I do with this. And you got to see the notebook I have for this. It's just a massive binder of just every little scene, every little handwritten note.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I really plan out a lot and try to flesh it out as much as I could. So, like I said, around
so you're,
4 months.
You're a plotter. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Have to
yeah.
be.
Definitely. And all. What I'd like to know is that now this is your very first book. So congratulations on finishing your very first book.
Thank you very much.
Will there be a sequel in the works?
Oh, of course, has to be.
And all.
Ahead,
so
I'm doing it
that's
right now,
the
actually.
Next book. Oh, that's what you're working on now. And
yes,
all. What is the name of it?
I haven't really decided yet, though. I want to have a cool little name next to it. Obviously, Aftermath will be the main club. I want a nice little, sub name to it, too. But I haven't gotten that far. I got to plan it out.
That's excellent. That's excellent. And, what I'd like to know is you're working on this one particular book. What drew you to do this one particular kind of book? I mean, what made you decide, okay, I'm going to write a book, I'm going to be an author, and then it's like, yeah, I think I'll do a cannibalistic, post-apocalyptic, really, really harsh type of story. What drew you to write that kind of book?
Well, to be completely honest, when I first started writing, I wanted to do like little kids' books and stuff like that. But somehow I found out the violence and the gruesomeness, that's what I was best at. So I decided to kind of stick with that, though.
Oh.
Like I said, I started writing this around the time of Hurricane Sandy. So there I am sitting in my house, no power, just, having a fire with my parents. I'm thinking, wow, what if the, power doesn't go out? I mean, what if it doesn't come on tomorrow or the next day or a week or a month? So then I got the idea of this book, though. Just, I don't want to dive too much into what happened or what changed the world, but it's just pretty much showing what would ordinary people do to survive. And that was the main thing of taking these characters, and I have each character has their own flashback scene, too. And, you know, some of them are very innocent. One of them is a high schooler. One of them is just a child. And you're seeing how far they've come since that point and what they actually had to do to survive. That's the main thing.
You
were
taking personal experiences and just kind of like it just blossomed into this story.
Yes, it really did. Like
oh,
I said,
wow.
That was amazing, just seeing what you're able to do to survive in this world.
Yeah. I'm reading from your webpage, and I like the readers to know this. Couple of paragraphs here intrigue me. I'm going to read directly from your website. The characters aren't just words on a page. They are extensions of me. They are real to me, and I am in control of their failures and successes. Sometimes it's nice to see some have happy endings. However, the problem is I like to take a real-life approach to my stories, and not everyone gets that storybook ending. I want to be able to do more with my writing than just sit at a desk all day and type. Yes, it would be ideal to have more money than I know what to do with, but I would like to do more than just that. I would like to start charities and give back to people and give a large portion of a book's profits to disease research. I would also like to start writing communities and give unknown writers the chance to showcase their work. But I can't look that far in the future now. I know right now I must focus on my own dreams before I can help others fulfill theirs or give back to the community. I do hope you enjoy what I write and hope I can produce more pieces that catch your interest. That is phenomenal. And most writers like, you know, well, I like it, and I hope readers enjoy my stuff, and we all do. But you've got a vision.
I definitely have plans for the future, and it all starts with this book. Bankrolls, everything else I would like to be able to do in life, like you mentioned about charities and everything, giving back to people, bringing unknown writers into. That's what I mainly want to do.
And the thing is, you're like 80% of all writers in that you've got a day job, and this is just something that you do. You know, people say, well, is it a hobby? Well, once you're a writer, it's not really a hobby.
It's a full-time job.
It's like a second job after you finish your day job. And hopefully, you know, at some point, you can make enough money on this second job to where you can afford to do all this other stuff other than pay bills and you know, put a roof over your head and food on the table. So, I mean, I've got to give kudos to you, Joe, for having this kind of vision as to what you'd like to do down the road.
Thank you very much. Because
you're not writing just so much for the enjoyment of writing. You've got a purpose and a plan for it. And that's very rare to see among writers. So I've got to hand it to you. And like I said, you've got a gem there in Alyssa. You know, don't let her go.
Oh, of course not.
I
never plan on it.
Anyway, the name is Aftermath, and it is by Joe Reyes. You've got to check the book out. In fact, you've got to go buy the book. You've got to go and see what all this is about, because this gets so in-depth, and it is, like he says, it's like a television series, episode after episode after episode, and you get so involved because there's not just Sarah, there's Carmen, there's Eric, there's Justin and Ron and Alice, and what all happens to them in this story and how their stories all tie in together into this book. So I strongly suggest go check it out, go get it. Also, check him out on his Facebook and his Twitter and his Instagram. And, Joe, thank you again for coming on the show. And when you get book two done, call me. You know where I live. Get you back on the show. I'd love to hear about the second book.
Oh, thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
And I appreciate you coming on the show tonight. My name is Linda Mooney. This is Other Worlds of Romance. Thanks for listening in. We'll see you again next week. Take care. And God bless. We'll see you then. Bye-bye. And we're done.
Oh, perfect.
So
thank you. That was really easy.
It was, yeah. And, I mean, I was sitting here and listening to her, and I'm just going, oh, my God, I can just see it in my mind's eye. I can see what's going on. That's just, it's phenomenal. And it's, like I said, I'm going to go get it. I got to see what happens to her poor baby and all. So you be careful, take care, and keep me informed what's going on with this book. Okie doke?
Of course. Yes, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate all this.
I really appreciate you all having on the show. So take care, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon, okay?
Oh, thank you. You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Good luck.